Hello, this is the Gordon Mudrug. From the S to the D to the F, I am the original SDF gangster. I'm a damn good cyber cheddar. And I like to go online. I'm a damn good cyber cheddar.
And today is Tuesday, February the 14th in the glorious future year of 2023. Now, February the 14th means that people will be thinking a great deal about romantic love. I admit that this is not a subject on which I am an expert. As a matter of fact, I have always considered myself something of a skeptic about romantic love. It's never meant all that much to me. But for today's program, I have a love story for you. I have Professor Moses Haddas, eminent linguist, reading his and interpreting for us Daphnis et Chloe, a love poem by the classical author Longus. Well, somewhat slightly post-classical, but you know, circa 200 AD, it's almost as good, right? And so, in a few minutes here, I'll be setting that on. And, frankly, if that doesn't take us to the end of the hour, which it may well not, I've also got the same gentleman reading for us from Virgil's Aeneid, the significantly less pleasant love story of Dido and Aeneas from the Aeneid. Anyway, but I wanted to remind you, so this past Sunday I started into reading on the Tubnik's live stream, All Men Are Brothers, which is a 1930s translation by Pearl S. Buck of the 14th century Chinese novel known as The Water Margin. And I got through the front matter, the prologue, and the first two numbered chapters. There are 70 chapters. And although it is true that the last chapter is quite short, I fully expect to be doing this on Sundays at 2200 UTC for several months into the future. So, for those of you who are interested in that kind of thing, Tubnik's, so updates to PeerTube, which is the software that Tubnik's runs, have made it possible for me to have a persistent live with replays. What that means is there's one URL that I can point you to that you can keep going back to every week. Let me drop that into comm here. And then the archive recordings will show up separately on my Tubnik's account. Which is pretty nifty. Anyway, so that's something that you can just keep going back to again and again. And as I say, I'm probably going to be reading this Chinese novel for quite a while, pretty regularly on Sundays. The duration of live streams with replay using PeerTube, or at least Tubnix's implementation of it, is set at 5 hours. So if I start at 2200 UTC, that gives me 4 hours of reading, and then whenever what I'm reading ends during the hour of 0200, I can call in to the SDF Open VoIP Hour and chat with anyone who wants to chat about the book. You know, if you've been listening and you're interested in it, you want to talk about it, that's an opportunity to do that. This past weekend, right, mostly SDFer Nick G called in and mostly wanted to talk to me about computer questions for which I have no answer because I am not a Unix guru. Sorry. Anyway, but if I have got the, if I've got everything set up right, I should be able to play this record. But yeah, so, you know, I was soliciting people to, contribute to my Patreon campaign, and, you know, for, and saying, well, you know, you get mentioned during the live streams, and, you know, you might ask, well, hey, you know, what interest is that to me if I'm just, you know, if it's just the one day? Well, it's not just the one day. Believe me, I'm going to be at this book, you know, assuming I can clear 5 chapters in a given Sunday, you know, I'm going to be here 3 months easily reading this book. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up to you. Again, I'll mention that the video signal source I was using, you want to go back and look at the replay in the on my Tubnix account. The video source I was using was my what I call my 1970 webcam, a tube-based video camera. Now it uses a vacuum tube, a Plumbicon, only for the image pickup. The rest of the circuitry is transistorized and indeed has an integrated circuit in it. We're getting real fancy here. But I won't say that it is the only vacuum tube camera connected to the internet. I won't even say it's the oldest video camera connected to the internet, although it's probably in the top 100. There's probably not more than about 100 vacuum tube cameras that regularly get connected to the internet. But it is a black and white camera. Now I have a color vacuum tube camera, very crude color. It uses 2 tubes. One is to pick up the image, and the other is purely to pick up the color. It's a stripe tube. It's a JVC, same basic type of camera that was used with Betacam electronic news gathering decks. But it's not completely functioning right now, and I need to acquire a manual so that I can work on it. And I haven't yet succeeded in that, which is unfortunate. I may at some point be able to deploy a color tube camera in addition to the black and white tube camera, which could also be fun. But that hasn't happened yet. Anyway, I will now proceed to play Daphnis et Chloe by Longus, as interpreted for us by Professor Moses Hadass.
There was a time when the Greek romances were widely read, and like other elements in our Greek legacy, they have left their mark on European literature. Today, even people who know Greek epic and Greek tragedy very well are not likely to know that the Greeks also wrote prose romances, at a later period, to be sure. And many who do know the romance do not rate it very high. There is a simple reason for this neglect and this disparagement. Homer and Greek tragedy are so obviously different from their modern successors that we judge them by a different scale. And we find that however excellent modern work in the same genre may be, The Greeks have not been supplanted, but only supplemented, and still have significant things to say to us. The Greek novels, on the other hand, look so much like our own that we are tempted to judge them by the same scale, without realizing that their premises and their goals are different. If we assume that the Greeks were trying to do what Fielding or Dostoevsky or Dickens did, they failed badly, and we should be right to dismiss them as trivial. But in point of fact, their aims were quite different. The most significant distinction of the Greek novel from our own is that it was presented and received as a conscious art form, with no concessions to realism or naturalism, no attempt to beguile the reader into an illusion that he is being given a transcript of life. The analogous difference between Greek drama and our own makes this distinction very clear. By removing one wall of a lighted room and huddling 400 eavesdroppers in the dark, we try to make them feel that they're overhearing natural conversations between people who act as if they were unobserved. But Greek tragedy is frankly artificial. Setting, language, costume, gesture are all stylized, not imitated from life. In real life, would 15 elderly gentlemen spring simultaneously into song and dance to reveal their inmost and identical emotions? The Greek audience was not watching life, but a concentrated refraction of life through art. The writer of romance was governed by the same principles, and it is therefore irrelevant to complain, as we should legitimately complain in the case of a modern work, that the characters are too simple, the rhetoric too unnatural, the coincidences too implausible, the endings too contrived. The implausibilities and the happy ending are, in fact, an index to one of the main objectives of the romance. Today, we expect that there should be some logical connection between event and event, or between event and character, and we miss such links in the Greek romances. But these books came out of a world where the links of causality seem to have been broken, where men and their affairs are governed by a capricious fortune. It is the very incalculability of events that absorbs interest. Logic is supplanted by paradox, and emotion becomes sentimentality, to be savored for its own sake. The cavalier attitude to probability is not a mark of indifference, but a true reflection of current beliefs. Consequently, by making virtue triumph in the end, as they regularly do, our authors are consciously arguing that, appearances to the contrary notwithstanding, there is a divine power which does guide and protect its special charges. There is another function peculiar to the stylized romance which deals with frankly imaginary persons and events, a function which we today associate with a scientist's laboratory. A romance like Daphnis and Chloe, which you are about to hear, is something like a rigged experiment. An isolated valley is set up, external factors are controlled, and the conduct of the unspoiled hero and heroine, as it is affected by one factor after another, can be observed. In this valley, they had been exposed in infancy, and here they are kept throughout the period relevant to the investigation. We can watch the untutored awakening and progress of their love with understanding as well as sympathy. Disturbing influences, pirates, the woman of experience, the brigands, the careless gallants, are intrusions from the outer world. We can watch the effect of each in the process of maturing. The isolation and the study is brought to an end by the arrival of Daphnis's true parents. After the hero and heroine's trials, and after their and the reader's education, they resume their proper place in society, but even so, neither their nor hopefully the reader's life sinks back into the conventional pattern. Of the author of Daphnis and Chloe, we know no more than his name, which was Longus. His date is believed to be the 3rd century A.D. His Greek sounds something like this. En lesbo theron, en althe nymphon, theama eidon caliston hon eidon, econa graptein historian erotas. Calon men cae tu althos, polydendron, antheron, katariton, mia pege panta etrefe, cae ta anthe, cae ta dendra, alla he grafeit ap notera, cae technein echus aperitein, cae tichein eroticein, hoste poloi, cae ton xenon, cata femin esan ton men nymphon hicetae, tes de econos theatae. Gynaeces epautes tictusae, cae alaes paganoes cosmusae, paedia ecemina, poemnia trefanta, poemenes anaerumenoi, neoes syntetheminoi, leston catadrome, problemion embole. This is from the short proem in which our author tells us that his story is an interpretation of a picture he had admired. He writes it, he says, as an offering to Eros, the nymphs, and Pan, and as a delightful possession for all mankind. It will remedy disease, solace grief, bring fond recollection to him that has loved, and instruct him that has not loved. None indeed has escaped love, or ever shall, as long as beauty survives and eyes to see it. May the God vouchsafe me to retain prudence as I write of the vicissitudes of others. And here the story begins. In Lesbos there is a large and handsome city called Mytilene. It is divided by canals into which the sea flows, and adorned with bridges of polished white stone. You would think it was no city you looked upon, but islands. At a distance of some 200 furlongs from this city was the country property of a rich man, a very fair estate. Its mountains abounded with game, its fields with corn, its hills with vines, its pastures with herds. A wide beach of soft sand was formed by the sea, which washed the shore. On this estate, a goatherd named Laman tended goats, and there found an infant being suckled by a she-goat. The spot was an oak coppice and tangled thicket, with ivy winding about it and soft grass beneath. It was there the infant lay. To this coppice the goat would frequently run and then disappear. To stay with the child, she would leave her own kid. Laman watched her movements, being grieved to see the kid neglected, and when the sun was at its noonday heat, he followed her footsteps. Her he saw standing over the infant with the utmost caution to avoid treading upon it or hurting it with her hoofs, while the child, as if at its mother's breast, sucked greedy draughts of milk. To imagine Laman's surprise is easy. He approached nearer and discovered a male child, big and fine, and wrapped in swaddling clothes better far than beseemed his castaway lot. He had a little mantle of fine purple, a golden brooch, and a tiny sword with an ivory hilt. Laman's first thought was to appropriate the tokens and disregard the infant, but on reflection he was ashamed at conduct less humane than the goat's, and so he waited for night when he fetched all to his wife Myrtle, the tokens, the child, and the she-goat too. Myrtle was astonished at the thought of goats producing little boys, but Laman recounted his whole story, how he found it lying on the ground, how he saw it being suckled, and how he was overtaken with shame to leave it to perish. Myrtle shared his feelings, and so they hid the valuables, gave the child out as their own, and committed its nurture to the goat. And in order that the name of the child, too, should be suitably pastoral, they decided to call him Daphnis. Now, when 2 years had elapsed, a shepherd of a neighboring pasturage, Dryas by name, chanced upon a similar find and a similar spectacle. There was a grotto of the nymphs, a large rock hollow within and curved without. In that grotto were statues of the nymphs themselves, fashioned of stone. Before the cave there stretched a trim meadow of abundant soft grass, fed by the fountain's moisture. Within the grotto hung milk pails, angular flutes, flageolets, and reed pipes, the dedications of the shepherds of old. To this grotto of the nymphs, a ewe, newly lambed, regularly resorted, so that more than once the shepherd supposed her lost. He wished to chastise her, and so twisted green osiers in the shape of a noose and approached the rock. But on his arrival, a far different sight than he had expected greeted him. His ewe he found affectionately offering copious draughts of milk from her udder to an infant. The infant, for its part, eagerly turned its face, clean and shining, from one teat to the other, uttering never a cry. And after it had drawn its fill, the ewe licked the child's face with its tongue. This time it was a girl, and by it too there lay swaddling clothes and trinkets, a headband of gold, gilt shoes, and golden anklets. Heaven sent did Dryas consider his find, and learning from the sheep her lesson of compassion and parental love, he took the infant up into his arms, laid its tokens by in his scrip, and prayed the nymphs for good hap in rearing their suppliant. And when it came time to fold his flock, he returned to his steading, recounted to his wife the sights he had seen, and showed her the trove he had found. He bade her accept the babe as her own little girl, and so to rear it, keeping its origin secret. So then Nappe, for so was she called, at once became the mother and loved the child tenderly, as if she was afraid of being outdone by the ewe. To lend her motherhood credit, she too gave the child a pastoral name, Chloe. Both children grew rapidly and revealed a beauty more exquisite than became rustics. The lad was now turned 15 and the last 2 years his junior, when in the same night Dryas and Lamon saw a dream somewhat as follows. It seemed that those nymphs of the grotto were the fountain in which Dryas had found the babe, handed over both Daphnis and Chloe to a pert and pretty boy who had wings on his shoulders and carried a little bow and arrows in his hand. This boy then touched the lad and lass with a single arrow and enjoined them to follow a pastoral life, he to tend goats and she to tend sheep. When their foster parents saw this dream, they were distressed to think the children would be but shepherds. From their fine swaddling clothes, they had fancied a better fortune for them, and therefore it provided them better fare and taught them their letters and such other matters as rustics understand. Yet they considered that since the children had been preserved by divine providence, the divine behests must be heeded. And so, when they had communicated the dream to one another and had offered sacrifice to the winged boy, companion of the nymphs, his true name they did not know, they instructed the twain in their duties as shepherds and sent them out with the flocks. They learned how to pasture their herds before the noonday heat, and how, when its intensity was abated, when to take them to water, and when to return them to the fold, which of their charges required the crook, and for which the voice alone was sufficient. They were exceedingly happy with their charge, as if it were some high ministry, and they loved their sheep and goats more than is common among shepherds, Chloe because she owed her salvation to a ewe, and Daphnis because he remembered that it was a goat who suckled him when he lay helpless. The spring was at its prime, and everywhere flowers were in bloom, in the woods, in the meadows, on the hills. Now was there buzzing of bees, warbling of songbirds, frolicking of lambs. On the hillsides the flocks gambolled, the bees went humming through the meadows, and through the thickets the birds made minstrelsy. And with such springtide joy held everything in thrall, the young and tender pair imitated all they heard and all they saw. When they heard the caroling of the birds, they too burst into song. When they saw the sportive lambs, they too skipped lightly about, and the bees they imitated by gathering flowers. With some they filled their bosoms, others they wreathed into garlands and bestowed upon the nymphs. All their work they did together, and they tended their flocks nigh one another. Often would Daphnis restore her sheep that had strayed, and often would Chloe drive his two venturesome goats from a precipice. Occasionally one would take charge of both flocks, while the other was intent upon some pastime. Their amusements were of a childish and pastoral kind, Chloe hunting asphodel stalks, of which she wove traps for the grasshoppers, neglecting her flock the while. Daphnis cut slender reeds, perforated the intervals between the joints, fitted them together with soft wax, and then practiced piping till nightfall. Sometimes they shared their milk and wine and made a common meal of the provisions they brought from home. Sooner would one see the flock of sheep or goats separated from one another than Daphnis and Chloe apart. Trouble begins when Daphnis falls into a pit dug to trap wolves. Chloe pulls him out with the help of a cowherd named Dorkin. They went back to examine their flocks, and when they found that both the goats and the sheep were grazing quietly and undisturbed, they sat down at the stump of an oak and scrutinized Daphnis's body to see whether any part of it had been bloodied in the fall. No hurt of blood was to be seen, but his hair and the rest of his body were plastered with mud and dirt. To conceal the mischance from Laemon and Myrtle, he resolved to wash himself. With Chloe, then, he went to the grotto of the nymphs and gave her his tunic and scrip to hold while he stood by the fountain and washed his hair and all his body. Now his hair was black and full, and his body tinted by the sun. One might suppose it took its color from the shadow of his hair. Chloe looked on and thought him beautiful, and having never thought him beautiful before, she thought that the bath was what conferred beauty. As she washed his back and shoulders, his soft flesh yielded to her touch, and she privily touched her own flesh to try whether she were the more tender. For the time then, since the sun was at its setting, they drove their flocks home, and Chloe felt no other sensation except that she mightily desired to see Daphnis at his bathing again. On the following day, when they reached their pasturage, Daphnis sat under his usual oak and played on his pipe, and while watching his goats, who seemed to take pleasure in the music. Chloe sat nearby and looked, indeed, at a flock of sheep, but much more did she look at Daphnis, and again she found him beautiful as he piped. Now she thought it was the music that produced beauty, so she took the pipe up after him, that she too might become beautiful. Then she persuaded him to bathe again, and she watched him as he bathed and touched him as she watched. She went home filled with praise of him, and that praise was the beginning of love. What had come over her she did not know, being but a young girl and country bred, and never having so much as heard the word love pronounced. But restlessness governed her spirit. She could not control her eyes, and frequently she murmured, "Daphnis." She neglected her food, lay awake at night, was unheeding of her flock. She laughed and wept by turns. Now she would doze off, now start up. Her face turned pale and again burned with hot blushes. Not even a cow stung by a horsefly behaved so skittish. In a reverie she reasoned with herself as follows. I am sick for sure, but what the malady is I do not know. I am in pain, but can find no bruise. I am distressed, yet none of my sheep is missing. I feel a burning, yet am sitting in thick shade. How many times have I been pricked by brambles, yet I never cried? How many times have bees stung me, but I never lost my appetite? The thing that pricks my heart now is sharper than those. Daphnis is beautiful, but so are the flowers. His pipe makes fine music, but so does the nightingale. But flowers and nightingales do not disturb me. Would I could become a pipe so that he might breathe upon me, a goat that I might graze in his care. Ah, cruel water, only Daphnis did you make beautiful. My bathing was useless. I perish, dear nymphs, and you do nothing to save the maiden who grew up among you. Who will crown you with flowers after I am gone? Who will take care of my poor lambs? Who will tend my chirping cicada? It cost me much trouble to catch, so that its song might lull me to sleep in the grotto, but now I cannot sleep because of Daphnis, and its chirping is useless. Dorkin and Daphnis dispute their merits, and Chloe, as umpire, rewards Daphnis with a kiss. The results are startling. Daphnis, as if he had been bitten rather than kissed, suddenly became gravity itself. He shivered by fits and could not control his palpitating heart. He wanted to look at Chloe, but when he looked, he was suffused with blushes. Then, for the first time, did he admire her hair because it was yellow, and her eyes because they were big and soft like a heifer's, and her face because it was truly whiter than his own goat's milk. It was as if he then first acquired eyes, having had none before. Now he took no food more than a morsel to taste, no drink except to wet his lips, and that under compulsion. Now was he fallen silent, who had been more chattering than the crickets, now sluggish, who had been brisker than a goat. His flock was neglected, his pipes flung away, his face was paler than summer grass. To Chloe alone was he talkative, and if ever he was away from her, he would spin such fond soliloquies as this. What in the world has Chloe's kiss done to me? Her lips are softer than rose petals, her mouth sweeter than honeycomb, and yet that kiss was sharper than a bee sting. Often have I kissed kids, often have I kissed young puppies, and the calf which Dawkins gave me, but this is a new kind of kiss. My breath leaps out, my heart jumps about, my spirit melts, and I want to be kissed again. Ah, that bad victory. Ah, that novel malady of which I do not even know how to say the name. Can it be that Chloe tasted some poison when she was going to kiss me? Then why did she not die? How cheerily the nightingales sing, but my pipe is silent. How gaily the kids gambol, and I sit listless. How richly the flowers bloom, and I weave no garlands. The violets and hyacinths are in flower, but Daphnis droops and withers. Shall Dawkins be looked upon as handsomer than me? Such things did our excellent Daphnis suffer, and such things did he say when he first tasted the effects and the language of love. Dawkins lays an elaborate trap for Chloe, which happily miscarries. So innocent are Daphnis and Chloe that they do not realize his purpose, but are sorry for his discomfiture. And now spring wears into summer. Now spring was ended and summer begun, and all things were at their prime. The trees were laden with fruit, the fields with grain. Pleasant was the chirping of the crickets, sweet the aroma of fruit, delightful the bleating of lambs. One might fancy that even the rivers in their gentle course murmured soft music, that the breezes piped when they breathed upon the pines, that apples fell to earth out of love, and that the sun, who was a lover of beauty, stripped all things of their covering. All these things warmed Daphnis, and he plunged into the rivers. Sometimes he bathed, and sometimes he chased the fish that swirled about in the water. Sometimes he drank deeply as if to quench the fire within. Chloe, for her part, after she had milked the ewes and also many of the goats, had much trouble thickening her cream, for the flies vexed her and would sting if she tried to drive them off. But afterwards she washed her face, put on a garland of pine twigs, girt herself in her fawn skin, and filled a piggin with wine and milk to share with Daphnis. But when noon came on, their eyes succumbed to ravishment. For when Chloe looked upon Daphnis nude, his beauty smote her in a mass, and she melted and could find fault with no part of him. And when Daphnis saw her in fawnskin and pine wreath holding the piggin out to him, he thought it was one of the nymphs of the grotto he beheld. The pine then he snatched from her hand and crowned his own with it, first covering the wreath with kisses. And when he stripped for his bath, she dressed herself in his garments, having kissed that. Sometimes they pelted each other with apples and dressed each other's hair, dividing the locks. She likened his hair to myrtle because it was dark, and he her face to an apple because it was fair with ruddy tinge. He would teach her, too, to pipe, and when she began to breathe into the instrument, would snatch it from her and run over the reeds with his own lips. He seemed to be correcting her fault, but was bestowing decent kisses on Chloe by means of the pipe. A band of pirates descend on the valley and abduct Daphnis. Dawkins, whom the pirates had wounded fatally, contrives to recover Daphnis by piping to his cows. After the burial of Dawkins, Chloe took Daphnis to the nymphs and brought him into the grotto and there bathed him. And she herself then, for the first time, bathed her body in the sight of Daphnis. White it was, and pure in its beauty, and needed no bathing to make it beautiful. Then they gathered flowers, such blooms as that season afforded, and they crowned the statues and hung Dawkins' pipe on the rock as a votive offering.
I beg a moment's indulgence while I get the record ready to play side two. So, yes, this is for your Lupercalian celebrations. Right. A love story from 1800 years ago or so. I don't know if there were lots and lots of infants being abandoned, you know, to be suckled by goats with, tokens of their parentage just in case, so that they wouldn't necessarily end up, you know, and I don't know. I have no idea if the description of these events reflects anything that actually happened in the classical period, or it was entirely a creation of the fabulists. But yes, today, I suppose most places, you know, you're not going to get the boys at the high school running around the running track being having what nettles or something, and having the girls stand by the side of the track, thwacking them with various bits of greenery they've procured from somewhere. That classical custom seems to have fallen entirely out of favor. On the other hand, of course, tomorrow you'll be able to get chocolate at a discount. So that's nice. All right. I think the other side. I used the record spray and the record brush, and hopefully, despite the very crackliness of it, hopefully, the other side of the record will be all right to play. Because it is very crackly, as you've noticed.
The progress of their love is interrupted by an invasion of young gallants from Methymna, come for a holiday. They lose their boat when a goat belonging to Daphnis eats its hawser. Daphnis is badly beaten, but saved by his rustic friends. To avenge their honor, the Methymnians send a naval force which abducts Chloe and her and Daphnis's flocks. Daphnis is distraught. When quiet had fallen, Daphnis went down to the plain where they were used to pasture, but he could see no goats, or come upon any sheep, nor find Chloe. Everything seemed deserted, and he noticed the pipe with which Chloe was used to amuse herself lying where she had thrown it. Then he cried out and lamented pitifully, and ran to the beech tree where they used to sit, and then to the sea if he could catch sight of her there, and then to the nymphs where she had taken refuge when she was dragged off. There he flung himself down on the ground and heaped reproaches on the nymphs as traitors. 'Twas from you that Chloe was ravaged, and could you endure to look on patiently? She it was who wove garlands for you, she it was who poured you libations of new milk. Hers is this pipe that hangs here as an offering. Never a single goat of mine did a wolf ravage, but now marauders have carried off the whole flock, and my fellow their shepherdess. My goats they will flay, the sheep they will butcher, and Chloe will be living in the city. With what face can I return to my father and my mother without my goats and without Chloe? I will be called slacker and deserter. I have nothing to tend. Here will I lie down and wait for either death or another enemy raid. Ah, my Chloe, are these your feelings too? Do you remember this plain and these nymphs and me? Or are you comforted by having the sheep and the goats as your companions in captivity? Pan answers Daphnis's prayer by sending a panic upon the Methymnians when they go ashore for the night. Suddenly the whole earth seemed to blaze out in a bright flame, and the rhythmic beat of oars as of a great fleet setting towards them was heard. Someone shouted to the commander to arm himself. One called out to another. Some thought they were wounded. Some lay in the likeness of death. It was all like a night battle with no enemy there. After so terrifying a night, the day following was more frightful still. The goats of Daphnis and the she-goats too had branches filled with ivy berries on their horns, and the rams and ewes of Chloe howled like wolves. Chloe herself appeared, crowned with pine. The sea itself showed incredible prodigies. The anchor stuck fast in the bottom of the sea when men tried to raise them, and the oars were shattered when they dipped them into the water. Dolphins sprang out of the brine and struck the vessels with their tails and loosed their joints. From the top of the cliff, which towered sheer over the headland, there was heard the sound of a pipe, producing, however, not the pleasant notes a pipe yields, but terrifying heroes with a trumpet blast. The men were confounded and ran to their weapons and called out the enemy, though they saw none. They prayed for night to return to give them a truce to their terrors. About midday, the general fell into a sleep, not without divine agency, and Pan himself appeared to him and said, "Men most impious and wicked of all, how did you dare perpetrate such mad outrage? The fields which are dear to me you have filled with the tumult of war. The herds of cows and goats and sheep which were my peculiar care you have taken as plunder. You have dragged from the altars a maiden of whom Eros wishes to fashion a tale of love. You showed no reverence for the nymphs who were looking on, nor for me, Pan. Never, sailing with such booty as this, will you see Methymna again. Never will you escape the terrors of the pipe which has confounded you. I will drown you in the sea and make you food for fish, unless you restore to the nymphs, Chloe, and Chloe's flock, both the goats and the sheep. Stir yourselves, therefore, and disembark the girl and the animals. Then shall I be your guide by sea and hers by land." Chloe and the flocks return in style, and a Thanksgiving festival with piping and storytelling and rustic dances are celebrated. Daphnis and Chloe advance to swearing eternal fidelity to one another. At the beginning of the third book, the Mytileneans plan to avenge the Methymnean outrage by declaring war. But all is amicably settled without recourse to arms. Now winter comes. So was settled that war between the Methymnians and Mytileneans, the beginning and end of which were equally unexpected. But more formidable than war was the winter which followed for Daphnis and Chloe. A sudden and heavy fall of snow blocked off all the roads and shut the farmers indoors. Wintry torrents rushed down the hills, ice froze hard, the trees seemed overwhelmed with their weight of snow, and all land disappeared except a little at fountains and streams. No one took flocks out of doors. At cockcrow they would build up a big fire, and some twisted linen, some wove goat's hair, and some fashioned nets for birds. At the same time they took care to supply the mangers of the cattle with chaff, the coats of the goats and sheep with beeves, and the styes of the pigs with holmberries and acorns. When everyone was thus of necessity housebound, the farmers and shepherds generally were pleased at this respite from their labors, this opportunity to take leisurely meals and to sleep long hours. To them winter appeared a more agreeable season than summer or autumn or even spring. But Chloe and Daphnis could only think of their interrupted delight, their kisses, their embraces, their happy meals together. They passed nights of sleeplessness and sorrow and awaited the return of spring as a new birth after death. They were stung with pain if a scrip out of which they had eaten came into their hands, or if they chanced to see a pail from which they had drunk together, or a pipe now cast away in neglect which had once been a lover's gift. They pray to the nymphs and Pan to release them from these woes, and again to show them and their flocks the sunshine. And as they prayed, they sought some device by which they might see one another. Chloe was altogether at a loss and helpless, for her foster mother was always at her side, teaching her to card wool and whirl the spindle, and speaking also of matrimony. But Daphnis had more leisure and was more inventive than the girl, and so contrived the following device for seeing Chloe. In front of Dryas's cottage, and indeed under the cottage itself, there grew two large myrtles and an ivy, which formed a grotto-like arbor. From the vines hung abundant berries as large as grapes. Quantities of winter birds flocked to the place for want of food elsewhere. There were blackbirds, thrushes, wood pigeons, starlings, and other birds that feed on ivy berries. On the pretext of hunting these birds, Daphnis filled his scrip with honeyed cakes and went out. To obviate all suspicion, he took birdlime and snares also. Though the distance was not more than 10 furlongs, the snow was still solid and made the road toilsome, but neither fire nor water nor Scythian snow can stand in the way of love. On the run, then, Daphnis arrived at Dryas's cottage, and after shaking the snow off his legs, he set his snares, smeared long sticks with birdlime, and sat down to fret over the birds and Chloe. As for the birds, quantities came, and a large number were caught, so that Daphnis was fully occupied in collecting them, killing them, and plucking their feathers. But no one at all came out of the cottage, man, woman, or chick. The whole household were hugging the fire inside. Daphnis was completely at a loss, and thought he had come at an ill-birded time. He ventured to look about for an excuse for knocking on the door, and pondered on what he could plausibly say. "I have come to get fire for kindling, but you have neighbors within a furlong. I came to ask for bread, but your scrip is stuffed with victuals. Please give me wine, but you had your vintage only the other day. A wolf has chased me, but where are the wolf's tracks? I have come to hunt birds. Well, then, you have hunted. Why don't you go home? I want to see Chloe, but who could make such a profession to a girl's father and mother? Everywhere I am balked into silence. Nothing I can say is free of suspicion. It is better to hold my peace. Chloe I shall see in the spring, since I am fated, as it seems, not to see her during the winter." Such was the course of his reverie, and so he gathered his bag together and prepared to leave. But, as if Eros took pity upon him, the following then happened. Dryas and his household had sat down to table. The meat was portioned out, the bread was served, the wine bowl mixed. One of the sheepdogs snatched some meat while no one was watching and ran outdoors. Dryas was annoyed. It was his portion the dog had taken. And so he grabbed a stick and followed the dog's tracks like another dog. His chase took him by the ivy arbor, where he spied Daphnis slinging his catch over his shoulders, determined to leave. Meat and dog alike immediately left Dryas's mind, and he shouted, "Hello there, boy!" He embraced him and kissed him and took him by the hand and brought him into the house. When the lovers saw each other, they nearly collapsed, but they found strength to stand upright while they saluted and kissed one another. In point of fact, their embrace served as a buttress to keep them from falling. Beyond his expectations, then, Daphnis got a kiss and Chloe herself. He sat down near the fire, and from his shoulders he unloaded onto the table the wood pigeons and the thrushes, and he explained how he had found keeping at home tedious and had gone a-hunting, and how he had caught the birds. The family praised his energy and bade him eat what the dog had left, and told Chloe to pour him a drink. She was very willing, but served the others first and Daphnis after them. She pretended to be angry because, having come so far, he was going to run away without seeing her. Nevertheless, before she handed him his drink, she sipped a little of it and then gave it to him. And he, though he was thirsty, drank very slowly, making his pleasure as long as possible by his delay. The table was quickly cleared of bread and meat. Then, as they sat about, they inquired for Myrtle and Lamon, and they felicitated them on their good fortune in having such a provider for their old age. Daphnis was well pleased at being so commended in the hearing of Chloe. And when they insisted that he stay on the ground that they were going to sacrifice Dionysus on the following day, it wanted but little for Daphnis to adore them instead of the god. When day dawned, the cold was very sharp, and the blast of the north wind parched everything. Dryas and his household arose, sacrificed a year-old ram to Dionysus, and kindled a big fire to cook the dinner. While Nappy was baking bread and Dryas boiling the ram, Daphnis and Chloe were free to go to the arbor where the ivy was, and again they set snares and smeared birdlime and caught a good quantity of birds. They also enjoyed constant kisses and delightful conversation. "'Twas for you I came, Chloe. I know, Daphnis. 'Tis because of you I destroy these poor blackbirds. What do I mean to you? Do you think of me? I do think of you by the nymphs by whom I swore in that grotto. We shall go there again when the snow has melted. But there is so much of it, Chloe, I'm afraid I shall melt before it does. Courage, Daphnis, the sun is warm. Would it were as warm as the fire that burns my heart. You are joking to deceive me. No, by the goats by whom you bade me swear. Thus antiphonally did Chloe respond to Daphnis, like an echo. Many other times did he make the trip, on other pretexts, so that the winter proved not altogether devoid of love. And now spring was beginning, the snow melted, the earth reappeared, grass was sprouting. The other shepherds drove their flocks to pasture, but ahead of them all were Chloe and Daphnis, for they were themselves in the service of a greater shepherd. First of all they hastened to the nymphs in the grotto, thence to Pan and the pine, and then to the oak tree under which they sat, pasturing their flocks and kissing one another. They searched for flowers also, wishing to crown the deities. These, the nourishing zephyrs and the warming sun, had but newly caused to shoot. But they did find violets, narcissus, and pimpernel, and others that the early spring brings forth. Chloe and Daphnis also tasted the new milk of goats and ewes, and they wreathed the statues and made libation to them. Then they drew the first notes from their pipes, as if challenging the nightingales to sing, and these answered softly from the thicket. The young people are warned by the example of the amorous animals, but do not yet understand the art of human love. Daphnis is initiated into the mystery by Lycaonion, a woman from the city who is compassionate as well as amorous, but he is loath to apply his lessons out of consideration for Chloe. As the summer wears on, many rustic suitors ask for Chloe's hand. Daphnis is beside himself until the nymphs direct him to a purse of gold which the Methymnians had lost. Armed with this, he obtains the consent of Chloe's foster parents. But Laemon hesitates to consent for Daphnis, for he suspects that Daphnis's birth is too high for a rustic bride. With Book 4, autumn again approaching, the plot begins to unravel. There came a man from Mitylene, a fellow serf of Laemon's, and told him that a little before the vintage their master would come to discover whether the incursion of the Methymnians had worked any injury to his fields. The summer was already waning and the autumn approaching, so Laemon worked to give everything an agreeable appearance for his master's sojourn. He purged the spring so that he might have pure water. He carried the manure out of the yard so that the smell might not offend. He trimmed his garden to make it tidy. A thing of beauty was this garden, a fit pleasance for a prince. Laemon also instructed Daphnis to fatten his goats to the best possible condition, for the master would surely wish to inspect them on his long-deferred visit. As for the goats, Daphnis was confident that he would receive praise. He had doubled the number he had received. Not one had been carried off by a wolf, and they were fatter than sheep. But because he wished to win the master's goodwill for his proposed marriage, Daphnis showed very great diligence and exerted every effort. He took his flock out very early and brought them back very late. He watered them twice daily and looked out for the richest pasturage. He remembered to get new bowls and many milk pails and larger cheese racks. So solicitous was he that he oiled the goat's horns and brushed their shag. One might fancy he is a sacred flock of Pan. All his work on the goats was shared by Chloe, who neglected her own flock to have more time for Daphnis's charges, so that Daphnis thought it was her efforts that made his beasts so handsome. In order to provoke the landlord against Daphnis, and so have a free field for Chloe's hand, Lampis, one of her rejected suitors, spoils the beautiful garden just before the landlord is expected for the vintage. On the following morning, Laemon went to the garden to water the flowers from the spring and saw the whole place devastated. The destruction was plainly a vandal's, not a thief's. Laemon tore his shirt in tatters and cried, "Ye gods!" so loudly that Myrtle dropped what she was doing and dashed out, and Daphnis let his goats go and ran up. When they saw the carnage, they shrieked and wailed. This was a new kind of mourning for flowers. It was for fear of their master that they wept, but even a stranger would weep at the sight. The place was dismantled and only muddy ground was left. Blooms that had escaped the violent attack still flowered and shone and were beautiful even lying down. Upon them swarms of bees had settled, and their incessant buzzing was like a funeral dirge. Out of his consternation, Laemon lamented, How shall I now show this garden to my master? What will he say to me when he sees it? He will hang his old servant from some pine tree like a Marsyas. Maybe he will hang Daphnis too, blaming his goats for the destruction. Now they no longer wept for the flowers, but for their own calamity, and their tears were the hotter. Chloe grieved at the thought of Daphnis hanging, and prayed that their master might never come. She lived through heavy days of wretchedness, as if she already saw Daphnis under the scourge. The next day, the landlord's son, Astylos, arrives along with his toady, Gnethon. Astylos is very amiable, and agrees to take the blame for the ruin of the garden. He will say his horses broke loose and trotted down. But Gnethon conceives an unnatural passion for Daphnis, and begs Astylos to procure the lad for him from his father Dionysophantes. Dionysophantes and his wife Clearistae and their entourage now arrive. Dionysophantes was now of middle age, but tall and handsome and able to hold his own even with young men. In wealth he had but few peers, in virtue none. On the first day of his arrival, he offered sacrifice to the gods who preside over the countryside, Demeter and Dionysus and Pan and the nymphs, and set out a large mixing bowl for all present to share. On the days following, he inspected Laemon's work, and seeing the fields well furrowed, the grapevines flourishing, and the garden in order, Astylos had taken the blame for the ruined flowers. He was highly pleased and praised Laemon, and promised to set him free. After this, he visited the herds also to see the goats and their shepherd. Chloe ran away to the woods, for she was shy and timid before so great a crowd. But Daphnis stood his ground. He was girt in a shaggy goatskin and wore a newly stitched script slung from his shoulders. Both hands were occupied, one holding new-pressed cheeses and the other suckling kids.
Set, demon.